Scripture reading this morning is Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 18. Matthew 16, verses 13 through 18. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" So they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood are not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it."
Good morning. I do want to reiterate what's been said already, that is, we have an enormous opportunity coming up in the form of Friends and Family Day. It's been, for the last several years, probably our most successful outreach-related event of the entire church year. It's been an opportunity for you to invite your friends and family, as the name suggests, into a very low-pressure environment. I think one of the standoff points of the church is quite often people are expected to have something sold to them. You know, you come in. Have you been on one of those vacations where you go on the vacation and then they sell you a timeshare? I think a lot of people view Sunday morning as kind of like that, that you're going to get invited to this free service, but then here comes the sales pitch. And we work really hard to make Friends and Family Day very low pressure. You come with your friends and family. We have a fairly regular service. It's not anything out of the ordinary other than there's more of us and then we eat. And it's an opportunity to make a second first impression or a third first impression or however many impressions it takes until we get the point across that this is a good place to be and people start to pick up on that. This is a marvelous opportunity to do that coming up on the 10th. And so please take one of the postcards home, hand it out, mail it out, use the Facebook advertisement. Several of you have tried that. Whatever it is that's available to you that you want to do, just word of mouth. Go and invite folks, follow up with folks, tell them to come in. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for us as a congregation. This month we're going to be looking, I say this month, we're at the end of the month. This coming month we're going to be looking at a couple of sermons out of the book of Matthew. In fact, just by way of emphasis, other than Friends and Family Day, we're going to be in the book of Matthew on Sunday mornings almost till the end of the year, through towards the end of November. Is going to be kind of our text of choice as we move through the last half of that book in a couple of different series, a couple of different themes. But for the next three or four sermons, what we want to look at are stories Matthew tells here in kind of the middle of the Gospel of Matthew that relate to the person Peter. Matthew's Gospel has more to say about Peter than any of the other Gospel accounts. I don't know particularly why or what point of emphasis. I'm curious about it, and one of these days maybe I'll spend some time studying that. But for some reason, it was important in Matthew's gospel for the stories related to Peter to get told over and over in different ways, and quite often putting Peter in a not-so-good light. Once in a while, he fares pretty well. This is probably the best of the stories related to Peter we're going to look at today, and even it, I'm going to mess it up a little bit and make Peter look bad anyhow. But usually Peter doesn't come out looking great in these stories for whatever reason. In fact, Peter comes out looking a lot like us. And that's kind of the point of emphasis we're looking for in our sermon series. We are disciples quite a lot like Peter. And we need, apparently, these stories to help us to be the disciples that instead that Christ would have us to be. Today's story comes from Matthew chapter 16, 13 through 20. It's a fairly well-known text. You'll recognize some of the phrases, perhaps. This is the story of Peter's great confession. If you get a study Bible, depending on who published the study Bible, you may get as much as a page and a half to three-quarters of a page of explanation trying to tell you what's going on in this passage because so much has been said, for better or worse, about the significance of it. What is clear is it's significant. Something important happens in this particular story. We're going to start in verse 13 and read just a couple of verses here and see if we can get the setup appropriately. "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." A couple of points of note. This is a pretty seedy place, just to give you a little geography and cultural background. Caesarea Philippi is not the place you go on family vacation in the first century. One commentator I read, I think, overstated it, but referred to it as the red light district of Palestine. I think that was a little bit overstated, but it gets the point across that this was a place known to be a seedy place. This is a place of very questionable morality. The religion of Rome and Greece and of all of the paganism had really set up shop here in Caesarea Philippi. It's even named after not Jewish figures, but upon their foreign leaders, right? Caesar Philip, Caesarea Philippi. These are the names of the city. And it's a city that was rooted in a lot of evil that went on there and had a reputation as such. That's where Jesus comes to ask this question and to do his teaching. His disciples might have been a little surprised they were even there. If you're making your trip and you get out your map and we're going to go and proclaim the kingdom of God, Caesarea Philippi is not the place that goes first on your order of business. It's a place, in fact, given the opportunity, you might prefer to go ahead and avoid. Jesus goes to exactly this place, and with his disciples, he asks this question: "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" Son of Man is itself a little bit of a cryptic title in the Scriptures. We don't always know exactly what Jesus means by it, because it can mean several different things. In ancient literature, especially ancient Jewish literature, sometimes Son of Man just means me. So if you wanted to refer to yourself without saying your name, you'd just say, "Well, the Son of Man thinks we ought to go get dinner." That sounds really strange in English. There's no way to make it sound normal. But in ancient writings, that was fairly typical for rabbis to say, "It's the opinion of the Son of Man," and refer to themselves as a person. The Son of Man seems to also emphasize a person's humanity as a human being, Son of Man, in contrast to the title that Peter's going to give in just a moment. But also it's rooted in the Old Testament scriptures in various places in the prophets with a figure that they hoped may come. In the book of Daniel, for example, Daniel says in chapter 7 that "I saw one likened to the Son of Man coming into the clouds of heaven to the Ancient of Days." And so he takes the role of a prophetic figure. This is Jesus' most common phrase referring to himself. When Jesus talks about himself, he is more likely to say Son of Man than he is Son of God or any other title about himself. And which is interesting because it's one of the most cryptic. What do you mean? Do you just mean this guy, me? Or do you mean the mysterious prophetic figure of Daniel or something else? It's hard to say, and maybe that was the point. Who do people say that I, the Son of Man, am? What do people say? Polls are interesting. We're always interested in polls. Do we always agree with polls? No, I don't. Isn't that interesting? The polls show us what the majority of people think, and yet the majority of people don't like what polls say. And it's a strange little thing. We want to know, we're curious about what people think, and yet we're distrustful of it. And such is the case here. He wants to know, what are the people saying? What are they saying in particular about Jesus and his identity? And his disciples give him an answer. Some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. That's a pretty great list. If I ask, who do people say Ben Williams is, and you start naming off the greatest preachers of human history, I'm going to say, that's pretty good. That's not bad. I could do worse than that, right? I could be okay with that particular list of names. And so when they give this list, it's an impressive list. Maybe you're John the Baptist. Now, as a contemporary figure, there was nobody more notable in Palestine than John the Baptist. Everybody wanted to know about John the Baptist. Herod wants to know about John the Baptist. Everybody's interested. He has turned the cities and the regions and the countryside of Palestine upside down. Mark chapter 1, verse 1 goes so far as to say, all Judea went out to be baptized of John. I mean, he was a notable figure. They say maybe you're him. Others reached back into Jewish history. And this is no small list either. How about Elijah? Elijah's the prophet, folks. When you talk to a Jewish person about the Old Testament, and you talk about heroes, Elijah is the man. Elijah is the one that they think of. When they describe, now here's something different. When we talk about the book of 1 and 2 Kings, we call it a historical book. If you ask a Jewish person, what's the book of 1 and 2 Kings? They say it's one of the prophets. Well, why would it be called a prophet book? Because it's about the prophets. It tells the story of Elijah and Elisha. To them, that's what the book was about. It was about the prophets whipping the kings into shape. And he was a hero. Jesus, they say you could be Elijah or Jeremiah. Jeremiah, what a brave and also miserable figure in the Old Testament. The man whose job it was at the day of Judah's doom to say, this is what God said would happen. So take your medicine. And he wrote enormous amounts of the Old Testament himself. Or maybe one of the other prophets. Apparently everybody had a figure. Everyone had a theory over who it might be. I'm a Star Wars fan. I'm maybe more than a Star Wars fan. I might have a problem. I really like Star Wars. And so once in a while, I like to read, you know, what are the current theories? You know, here for too long, the next Star Wars movie's going to come out. And everyone needs to know, who is Rey? Who's her parents? And what's the theory? And there are these great figure, these great mysterious plots that people have engineered. Well, she's actually the reincarnation of this figure from somewhere else in another movie, and it's going to be exciting. People trying to guess what's going to happen, right? Everyone's got a theory because it's captivating. You feel like you don't know, but it's got to be big because we don't know. It's got to be huge. It's going to be really boring. That's not going to happen. We're going to get to the next Star Wars movie, and her dad's going to be named Bob. He has no interest whatsoever in anything going on in the movie. He's just another guy. He ran a pet store. That's going to be what happens. Well, in reality, we feel like it can't be that. That story's too big to have a boring ending, so it's got to be important. Everyone knows there's something special about Jesus. Everyone's got a theory. But what I notice about this list is that people are willing to say that Jesus was great. And notice that word that I want to use there. People were willing to say that Jesus is great. And I want to tell you that is still the case today. When you read the story of Jesus, he is a captivating and compelling figure. There are very, very few people who read the story of Jesus and say, I just don't like him. There are people who don't believe in him. There are people who don't want to be affected by him. There are people who disobey him. But there are very few people who find him unlikable. As a figure, he teaches beautiful lessons about ethics and morality. He seems to care about people that other people don't care about. He's kind. He's loving. He's compassionate. What is there not to like? Today, if you ask people about Jesus, it is a very, very small minority, even in the skeptical academic community, that would say, well, there's no such person or he's a fiction. Most of them will say, yeah, he's a real person. In fact, he's probably even a great person. It's hard to ignore that. Most of Western civilization's history has something to do with this man, whether it's the way we tell time or the rise and fall of empires. It has something to do with Jesus. The Roman Empire was the greatest empire of its day, and within three centuries of trying to exterminate Christianity, they gave up and tried to join it. Christianity mattered, and this Jesus mattered. Most people are willing to say that Jesus is great. What I want to suggest to you is that the point of this story is that that is actually not enough. It is not sufficient to say that Jesus is great, although that's the confession that most of us are comfortable with making. Jesus turns to Peter, and he said to them, to the disciples at large, "But who do you say that I am?" And it's brave, brave Peter who responds. Maybe Peter just says what everybody else is thinking. I don't know, but Peter says it. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." What Peter claims is not that you are just great, that you are worthy of some magnificent title, like people who have gone before. What Peter claims is that you are greatest, that you are something that no one else has ever been, that no one else will ever be. You are what you and you alone could and can be and must be. First, you are Christ. This is the Hebrew term for Messiah. He is the long-awaited one. You read the Old Testament, 39 books of wait. 39 books of God's going to make it better, just wait. 39 books of one day God is going to set us straight, just wait. And the figure they had hung all of those hopes on of God putting things to right was the anointed of God, the Messiah. Peter says, you're him. See the difference? The people said he's a prophet. He's going to be like Jeremiah. Jeremiah told us one of these days God's going to put everything right. Peter says, no. You're not a prophet telling us what God's going to do one of these days. You're the one we're waiting on. You're the one doing it. You're the one Jeremiah waited for. You're the hope of the nations. What Peter says is you're not great, you're greatest. You're not good, you're best. You are the Son of the living God, which is a great response to the original question. What do people say about the Son of Man? Peter says, I say he's the Son of God. And while that phrase actually can mean a whole lot of different things, in the Scripture it's very clear what is meant by it. That Jesus is of very nature God. He is divine. That he is not like you and me in every sense. In many ways, oh yes, he's a lot like us. Jesus is walking through a town called Caesarea Philippi. You know how he walked? 1 foot at a time, just like everybody else on that road that day. You know what his feet were? Dirty and smelly, just like everybody else's that day. In some ways, he's just like us, but Peter says, no, you're more. You are the Son of the living God. We're in Caesarea Philippi. There were tons of gods. Oh, we're surrounded by God. Pan was one of the favorite of Caesarea Philippi. Pan wasn't a great god. Pan was pretty lousy. As gods go, Pan was downright scandalous. He was always into trouble. And all kinds of gods surrounded this region. Peter says, you're the Son of the living God. They are dead. They are fake. They are nothing. There is one true God and you are his Son. What Peter is claiming is that Jesus is not great, but greatest. This next quarter, we're going to start a class on Sunday mornings in the auditorium and the Young Families class with the teens on Wednesday night, all the way throughout our program called Things That Matter. And it's an introduction to the first principles of Christianity. And the reason it's titled Things That Matter is because of this point. There are lots of things that matter a little. There is one thing that matters above all else. Lots of things that are interesting in life, lots of things that are even great, only one thing that is greatest. And that's where our attention needs to be focused and centered. What Peter is claiming is you are the thing that matters. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. There was an interview, it was fascinating. I think it was in the New York Times. I'm going to have to think now. Should have written it down. It was at the end of 2016, so it's been almost a year. It was an interview with Presbyterian minister Timothy Keller, who is a Christian apologist and defender of the kind of basic principles of Christian faith and well-known for it. And the interviewer asked Keller this question. He said, now you believe a lot of this traditionally Christian stuff. I don't believe a lot of that stuff. I believe Jesus is a good guy. I believe Jesus is a good teacher. I consider myself a Christian. But I don't believe Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary. I don't believe he was raised from the dead. I don't believe he walked on water. Pastor Keller, do you believe that I am a Christian? Now, what a setup for a question, right? Here I am 2 inches in front of your face. Tell me whether or not you think I'm a Christian. Here's our lead-off question to an interview where you're supposed to make Christianity look good, right? I mean, you got one job. You're thinking, you've just published a book. Keller had just published several books. And he thinks this is going to be an interview about the books I've written and things I've done. Mr. Keller, do you think I'm a Christian? I don't believe a lot of that stuff you believe. Keller, I thought, had a brilliant answer, and I was glad to see it in one of our nation's leading papers. He says, you know, if I joined up with Greenpeace and said, I don't believe in global warming, or if I joined up with PETA and said, but I don't actually favor the humane treatment of animals, you would think that I was a little bit odd. In fact, you'd say, I don't think you belong here. Not because you're an exclusivist who just hates people who disagree with you, but because that's what it means to be one of those people. He says, Christianity has a body of beliefs, and it has for a very long time. You may think a lot of things about Jesus, but if you don't think these things about Jesus, no, you're not one of those Christians. And I thought, oh, that was good. Christians aren't people who think Jesus is great. Christians are people that think he is greatest, that believe this is the most important person who has ever lived, and that that fact holds sway over my life. And not only do we think it, I told you if you gave me long enough, I was going to make Peter look bad. He's doing good so far, about to change. We actually have to live like it. Peter says that Jesus is greatest, but in the next chapter when he's put to the test, he sometimes acts like he's just great. Look at this story now. Remember what we just read in Matthew 16. Look in Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 through 6. After 6 days, just 6 days, the next story, okay? Jesus took with him Peter and James and John his brother and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to him Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good that we be here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. And when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. What did Peter do? Look how closely related those two stories are. It's almost the same list of people. Who do the people say that I am? Well, you could be one of the prophets. But no, you're more than that. You're the Son of God. Then we get to the mountain, and Jesus is there among the prophets. And what does Peter do? Not what does he say, what does he do? He says, well, Jesus, you've got to be at least as great as these fellows. He's willing to believe something that he had really spoken against before. He's willing to act like Jesus is just one of the great prophets. Not the Son of God, but one of the great prophets. And to be clear, this was a compliment. You're one of the great prophets. You deserve to be admired like the greatest of our people. But God says, no, no, no. You forgot what you confessed in the last chapter. This is my Son. This one is my Son. Not that one and not that one. This one is something that no one else has ever been. And you listen to him like you've never listened to anybody else. He's not just great, he's greatest. And that's the trick, I think, for Christianity. It's not just, as Keller pointed out in the interview, there are certain things we need to be able to say about Jesus. He's not just good, he's great. He's not just great, he's greatest. It's more than that. We have to be able to act like it. I think when push comes to shove, while we might say wonderful things about Jesus, we are only willing to afford him just another piece of our life. And we think that's a big deal. You know, there's only so much of Ben's life to go around. Where do you spend your life? Well, I've got a job, and I spend some time on my job. I've got a family, and I spend some time on my family. I have a very small, limited number of hobbies and interests, which I spend too much time on. And you know what? I like Jesus so much, I'm going to give him that fourth part. In fact, I'll move the fourth part to number one, and I'll put it first. It'll be the first fourth part. This is how we treat Jesus. He gets one portion of our life. He doesn't want a portion of your life. He wants every bit of it. He doesn't want to be another great thing in your life. He wants to be all of it. He doesn't want to be recognized as one more voice to listen to. He wants to be the only voice you listen to. God at sundry times and divers manners spoke in days past by the prophets, but he hath spoken unto us in these last days by his Son. Jesus is the one who is speaking, and he's the one God says to listen to. He's not great, he's greatest. He doesn't want to be one part of your life. He wants to rule all of your life. And I think that's where Peter missed the boat. Gold star to Peter for recognizing the confession of the people wasn't great enough. but then I'm going to take his gold star back. Why? Because when it came to actions, he didn't know how to act like Jesus was actually greatest. Go back to Matthew 16 and see where Jesus applauds his first confession and what it actually means. In verses 17 through 19, now verse 16, Simon said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And this is where Jesus says, "Bravo." Verse 17 says, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Blessed are you. Peter, do you recognize how important this thing you just said is? This is not another earthly truth among earthly truths. This is not another clever motto to put on a bumper sticker. This is not a witticism that you can repeat and be proud of. Look at how clever I am. Do you recognize that what you have said is the very truth of heaven's God revealed to you? This is not some great truth of human life. It is the truth of human life. It is not great. It is greatest. Flesh and blood has not revealed it to you. Peter, do you recognize how significant this truth is? Peter's name means rock or stone. And so Jesus makes a little joke here. Peter's name describes a rock that is broken off of a great mountain. If you've ever been to Mount Rushmore, I've used this analogy before, but when they carved out Rushmore, they used dynamite and blasted big chunks of the mountain away, right? And or you go over to the Crazy Horse Memorial and see the same thing. Down at the bottom of the mountain are these enormous chunks of stone that were blasted off the mountain. You pick one up. Well, you can't pick one up. You get a crane and pick one up and you drop it down in our front yard out here. People are going to say, "Why is there a giant rock in your front yard?" But at the bottom of the mountain, it's meaningless. Nobody even looks at them except weird preachers looking for analogies. No one even notices that they're there, because the rock is so much greater. Peter, you're a rock, and that's fantastic. But this confession you have made, it's bedrock. It's the mountain. It's foundational. It's not one more truth that you're going to put into the list of things you know. Carrots are good for your eyesight. Early to bed, early to rise. You know, it's not one more proverb for you to remember. This is bedrock. This is the most important thing. How important? Upon this rock, I'm going to build my church. Jesus, do you even know where you're standing? You're in Caesarea Philippi. Isn't anybody building anything good in Caesarea Philippi? He says, if this truth is here, I could build it right here. Wherever this truth is, that's where the world's getting ready to change. I can build my church on this bedrock. How much so? The gates of hell cannot prevail against it. Hell there is rendered out of our Greek New Testaments from the word Hades, and it's a little hard to get a grasp of what's going on. Doctrinally speaking, I think Jesus probably is pointing to the fact that even human death will be defeated by the identity of Jesus Christ. But let me give you one more visual cue here to help you understand the significance of this passage. I've been telling you the whole sermon, we're in Caesarea Philippi, home of rich and wicked paganism. Caesarea Philippi, such a wicked place that many ancient peoples believed it was a little closer to the underworld than the rest of the world. There was a cove down the coast, a cave. You can go there today. There's a cave, and the water, as seafront caves often do, will rush in and rush out with the tides and big foam and blasting waves and things like that, and it's dark inside. You don't see what happens in there. It just goes in and disappears. And one of the superstitions of the region of Caesarea Philippi was that this was the very gate of Hades. This is the door to the underworld. You walk down that cave, you end up down there with the gods where they winter, where they go down and spend their time off-season. Pan makes his way there, and when he comes back, all the evil of paganism comes with him. I can almost see Jesus pointing down the coast and says, not even the gates of hell itself could prevail against the rock that you have confessed. The identity of Jesus is greater than what's here. It is greater than all things, because it's not just great and it's not just greater. It is greatest. Blessed are you, Peter. If Jesus, the truth of heaven, is known to you, then there is no greater blessing that could ever be yours. It is not one truth among many, and it is not one blessing among many. It is that which matters most. The choice you have this morning and every morning is to honestly assess where you stand with the identity and person of Jesus. You may be in that category I mentioned right up front. That's willing to say good things about Jesus, but not the greatest things about Jesus. Recognize Jesus for who he is. Not just another one of our greats, but the greatest. It could be also, though, and this one might hit closer to home, that you're willing to say great, maybe greatest things about Jesus. But when it comes to the actual choices and decisions of your life, he is just one more good voice among many. Jesus does not share. He wants you for his own. He does not want a part of you. He does not want a bit of you. He wants all of you. And he'll have it. If you will turn to him in faith and obedience, give yourself entirely to him. And every command that he gives, submit. Repent of your sins. Confess, as Peter does. And be baptized to begin a life as part of his body. The people that he built to recognize and proclaim the greatest to the world. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If there's anything we can do to help you with that, why don't you come?